Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We hear about the studies that tell us how many uninsured Americans are out there, roughly 46 million, but we hear less about the number of uninsured that die because they lack health insurance. That number ranges anywhere from a low of 18,000 to an estimated 46,000 a year. That's what we're going to talk about today. Joining us from Boston to talk about who they are, how they die, and what it costs the rest of us is Dr. John Iannian, a professor of medicine and healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School and a professor of health policy and management at Harvard School of Public Health. He is many other things as well. I don't have time to talk about it, but Dr. Iannian mostly is a practicing physician who has his own experiences with the uninsured. Welcome, Dr. Iannian.
Good morning.
Also in the studio is Darlene Honigford. She is a social services director for Central Ohio Diabetes Association. She not only works with people who are uninsured as a social worker, she also has experiences in her own family with people who have diabetes, which is a chronic condition that, if untreated, can kill a person. Dr. Iannian, tell us about the big numbers. Tell us about that 18,000 to 46,000 or 50,000 that researchers have found die every year because they are uninsured. The 18,000 figure comes from a 2002 report, and the 46 plus comes from a very recent report that came out. What do those numbers reflect?
The numbers reflect a number of studies that have been conducted over the past 15 years showing that adults without health insurance have an increased risk of dying prematurely. That increased risk has been estimated to range from 25 to 50% higher compared to people with insurance between ages 18 and 64. The rising number of potential deaths related to uninsurance relate to both the increased risk that we see as medical care gets more effective. If you're uninsured, you don't have access to those effective treatments for diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, other areas where we've made great strides in medical care in the past 20 years. And we also have seen, as many know, a substantial increase in the number of uninsured Americans over the past 20 years. So those two factors combine to potentially increase the number of Americans who are dying prematurely or unnecessarily because they lack access to good care.
In the study released in mid-September and published in the American Journal of Public Health, it was conducted at Harvard Medical School and Cambridge Health Alliance, and it shows that even taking into account socioeconomics, health behaviors, and baseline health, they have a 40% higher risk of death than their privately insured counterparts. What's the socioeconomic factor? What are we talking about there?
Sure. Well, we know from many surveys that people who are uninsured are more likely to be in low-income groups in the United States. For example, for people who are at less than the federal poverty level, which is about $21,000 for a family of four, the risk of uninsurance is 37%. For folks living at about twice the federal poverty level, between $42,000 and $64,000, that risk goes down to about 18%, and for those who have incomes over $85,000 approximately, the risk of being uninsured goes down to 5%. So we know that people with higher incomes and more education can have a better health for a number of reasons in addition to higher rates of insurance coverage. And when we do these studies, we need to control for those other factors to try and understand the direct effect of being uninsured.
Can you compare 2002 and or back in the early 2000s and now the most common reason a person lacks insurance? Has that changed over time?
It hasn't changed, but it's become more acute over the past 5 to 10 years. What we're seeing is that most Americans under age 65 get their coverage through their employers or through the family member who's a worker and is eligible for employment-sponsored health insurance. What we've seen with the rising costs of health care and the rising insurance premiums, which have approximately doubled between 1999 and 2008, we've seen that many small employers are no longer able to offer their workers health insurance, and even if it's offered, the premiums for that insurance have risen steeply, and many low- and middle-income workers may be unable to afford those premiums if they've risen to a large degree.
You know, earlier, Darlene and I were talking about folks who put off important, or I guess they're technically elective surgeries, but they're important to preserving their health. And I thought about, I've got good insurance, and I put things off because it's expensive still.
Certainly, costs are a problem for people with and without insurance. It's just that they are even more severe for those who are uninsured and therefore need to pay for their care out of pocket or rely on charity care from hospitals or physicians.
Younger people are an issue. Many are uninsured. They say out of choice that they don't value the access to coverage, that they don't want to pay the premiums because they really get sick. And is that accurate?
I don't think that's an accurate perception. There certainly are some young adults out there who may choose to go without insurance coverage even when it's offered and they can afford it. But most young adults, at least in our experience in Massachusetts, when offered an affordable insurance plan, young adults in their 20s and early 30s have a very high rate of taking up that insurance.
Folks have been talking about the Massachusetts plan. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how it works?
Sure. Well, Massachusetts used a combination of different approaches to reduce the rate of uninsurance in our state over the past 2 years from about 8 to 10% to now it's down to about 2 to 3% in the latest data from Massachusetts. That was accomplished both by for low-income residents of the state expanding opportunities for coverage through the Medicaid program, and very importantly for workers and middle-income families, the state forming an agency to help people purchase private insurance, something called the Commonwealth Connector, where they were able to pool many folks who might otherwise have to get insurance on their own or through a small employer. And when that risk can't be spread over a larger group, the premiums are even higher than they would be otherwise. So by working through the state to connect people with private insurance, they were also able to substantially increase insurance coverage among the employed population. And we've actually seen there was some concern that expanding the public coverage through Medicaid might crowd out some of the private coverage, but in fact, we've seen the opposite, an increase in both public and private coverage in the state.
When you're talking about that Commonwealth Connector, is that like the public option that's been eliminated at this point from the legislation at the federal level? Or is it more like you mentioned a pool?
Right. So it's a way to connect people with private insurance plans for low-income residents. There's a sliding scale for the premium, and the premium is subsidized by the state, but the insurance that they are obtaining is actually private insurance. And then one other important piece of the Massachusetts plan that's being debated in Congress now has been an individual mandate. The state political leaders making the decision that health insurance would be treated similarly to auto insurance. If you're a driver, auto insurance is required. And similarly, we now have an individual mandate that if you have access to an affordable insurance plan, and some people can request an exception or exemption to that if insurance is still unaffordable, but if you have affordable coverage available, you're required to adopt that coverage.
How long has this plan been used now? How long has it been in?
So it was enacted in 2006, and it's been a little over 2 years now, approaching 3 years that the plan has been in place.
And are there any conclusions you're able to draw from it yet about the issue that we're talking about today, the health of the uninsured? And how it's improved or declined?
Sure. It's still a little soon to make those judgments because many of the people who've gained coverage have just done so within the past 1 to 2 years. There are some survey data that have been collected by other researchers evaluating the Massachusetts plan, and they found that the proportion of adults who have access to a regular source of care, such as a primary care physician, has increased, particularly among low-income families, and the proportion of people who go without care because of cost has decreased over the past 2 years. So those are positive early indicators, but we'll need to follow the Massachusetts experience more closely over time to see what impact that has on people's health.
I think you've studied how the previously uninsured respond to Medicare or Medicaid coverage when they do qualify for it, and
yes,
compare them to the counterparts that have always been insured.
My colleagues at Harvard and I have conducted a series of studies over the past 5 years, particularly focused on middle-aged adults, people in their 50s and early 60s, who participated in a national survey that's been conducted every 2 years since 1992, titled the Health and Retirement Survey, trying to understand what happens to people's health and economic situation as they age through their 50s and 60s and become eligible for Social Security and Medicare. What we did was compare those adults in their 50s and early 60s who were uninsured with those who were continuously insured over that time period. And we've found a number of, I think, important effects of gaining Medicare coverage. First of all, we find that the uninsured use fewer services, particularly hospitalizations before age 65. But just as they gain Medicare coverage at 65, the rates of hospitalization increase fairly steeply and more so for the uninsured than those who were previously insured. And most of those hospitalizations are for conditions or complications that we believe could have been prevented with more effective care in a physician's office, for example, for diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, kidney disease, if people had access to regular care and consistent insurance coverage. So we see more admissions for heart attacks, heart failure, strokes. And then we also see more hospitalizations for some of those elective procedures that you mentioned earlier, but ones that can profoundly affect people's quality of life. So people with severe arthritis affecting their knees or hips often benefit from a total joint replacement. We find that the uninsured adults in their late 50s and early 60s postpone those procedures until after age 65.
And what are the
remedies?
Go on. I'm sorry.
And the last point I'd like to make is that we actually sort of look at people's overall health trends, how well do they feel mentally and physically through their 50s and 60s and into their early 70s. And what we find is the uninsured have worsening health at a more rapid rate before they turn 65. And once they gain Medicare coverage, they actually start to catch up with those who were previously insured. So that by about age 72, the difference in health between the insured and the uninsured is about half of what we would have predicted based on how their health was declining before gaining Medicare coverage.
I want to get back with this. So I have a few more questions on that topic, but right now we're going to take a quick break. We're talking about the ranks of the uninsured and how they get sick and die sooner than their insured counterparts. The latest study from Harvard puts that number at an estimated 46,000 a year. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us about a time that you were denied services because of a lack of insurance or a medical procedure that you've put off for the lack of insurance. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
And good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. At 1 o'clock, On Point will be here. Young people are fleeing small-town America in droves. On Point looks at a new report on the rural brain drain and the American heartland. That's on Point at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In the weather forecast, currently 42 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Sunshine this afternoon and a high of 65. Clouds tonight with a chance of rain and maybe a thunderstorm tonight and a low of 50 degrees. Cloudy and rain showers for Friday with a high of 65. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about healthcare policy and how the uninsured sometimes can cost us more money than we think. And Dr. Ayanian, we were talking about the previously uninsured and how they respond. Previously uninsured and how they respond to Medicare or Medicaid coverage once they get it. And you said that up to the point when they're covered, they tend to use fewer services. So overall, doesn't, and you said that many catch up once they do get the coverage. Doesn't that, I guess, save us as a society money in the long run then, just put it off?
Certainly, there's both a health cost and a financial cost, both for the individuals affected who are uninsured as well as for society. And to the extent that people are developing complications such as heart attacks or strokes during the period when they're uninsured or shortly after they gain insurance and then become more costly because of those complications, there is a potential through actually improving care and primary care and prevention for their subsequent costs, for example, in the Medicare program to be less than they otherwise would be with our current system.
I was reading an article from USA Today. I think it was last week. They did a big package on the uninsured, and they really worked hard at putting the face on it. They highlighted five or six people who are uninsured on all different walks of life, and they included what I thought were some what I think of as fun facts to know and tell. They published a chart that compares the U.S. to other countries, the usual suspects that were compared with Germany, Canada, the U.K., France, and we ranked last in life expectancy and infant mortality rate. But we ranked number one in inpatient surgical procedures with 90 per 1,000 population. The Netherlands, in contrast, was the lowest with 40 per 1,000 population. Dr. Ayanian, what does that reflect? Is that what you're talking about when you're saying they're putting things off, which means they need more when they do get it?
Well, the statistics that you just quoted more likely reflect how much Americans value health care as well as the fee-for-service system that we have that compensates physicians and surgeons for providing more care. Certainly, sometimes that care is necessary and essential, but there's more discretionary care in the U.S. And more procedures, both surgical procedures, imaging procedures like CT scans or MRIs, those factors combine, and are the costs in many ways are driven by the high volume of care that the uninsured population gets, as well as the prices for that care in the U.S. I think certainly the complications that the uninsured experience contribute to the high costs in the U.S. And I think that's one of the reasons in the policy debate that we're having now in Washington and in states across the country that we need to address both the problems of access to care for the uninsured or people with inadequate insurance, as well as the rising costs that affect everyone and run the risk of making health care too expensive even for people who are insured.
We were talking about the Massachusetts plan earlier. Why is that plan often shoved aside when it comes to the health care debate in Washington? When people say, well, look at Massachusetts, why doesn't that count? Why isn't it relevant?
Oh, I think it's most certainly relevant. And in fact, when I've met with members of Congress and their staffs, many of them are very interested in the Massachusetts experiment and, potentially – what we're doing in Massachusetts is a positive example of our federal system at work, where the other states and the federal government can learn from what's happening here. And we've made great strides, as I mentioned earlier, in lowering the rate of uninsured residents in Massachusetts from about 10% to 2.5%. But we still have the challenges of controlling costs in Massachusetts, as is the case in all other states in the country. So I think that when there is sort of concern or skepticism about the Massachusetts plan, it's not about the success we've had in covering people, but more the fact that we have not yet solved the problem of rising costs, which is the same problem being faced around the country.
Why are the rising costs so much steeper in the United States than in other developed countries?
It's an interesting question. When you look at this across countries, the actual rate of growth of costs may not be that much higher in the U.S. than other countries. It's somewhat higher. It's just that we are starting from a much higher level, in part because we value health care, I think, in, to a very high degree. And that's why it's the debate about health care reform has been so emotional. But and then I think another important factor is that prices for most medical services are substantially higher in the U.S. than in other developed countries.
Could you explain to me what you mean by we value healthcare more? What exactly do you mean? Because I know people in France want to be healthy too. They eat better.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't mean to imply that the people in other countries don't value it. I just think, my experience as a physician is that we have made great strides in improving medical care over the past 20 years in terms of the things that we can do to treat diabetes or high blood pressure and prevent complications of those conditions. Some of the new innovative surgical procedures that we have that are less invasive and thus safer and can be provided to larger numbers of patients. And so with those advances, we have many people in the U.S. who are sort of living testament to the benefits of good medical care, and so we value that good care and the results, the better health that it provides.
My guests today are Dr. John Iannian. He is a practicing physician, but he's also a professor of medicine and healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School, and a professor of health policy and management at Harvard School of Public Health. And Darlene Honigford, she hasn't spoken yet, but Darlene, you're here, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay. She's a social services director for the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. If you would like to join our conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I just want the listeners I want to remind them that we are not talking politics today. We're talking about what happens when you're uninsured in America. How do you live? What's your lifestyle like? Let's put the politics aside and let's talk about the bottom line. Darlene, let's talk about the bottom line. You represent people who suffer from diabetes. Why don't you tell me the statistics about diabetes and how much it affects the bottom line when it comes to the uninsured in America?
Well, diabetes is one of the fifth leading causes of death in the country, and the complications from uncontrolled diabetes is pretty horrendous. The loss of vision, the kidney amputations, the heart attacks, the strokes, and so the proper health care that somebody living with diabetes that they need to keep themselves healthy is really important.
Give me a progression, a lifestyle progression of somebody who's diagnosed with diabetes. Well, there's different kinds. So you tell me what's the most common and what's the progression if they have insurance.
Yes, you're right. There are as many kinds of diabetes out there. The two ones that people think about the most is type 2, which is the 90% to 95% of people living with diabetes have. And that's when their pancreas is making some insulin, but either not enough or the body can't use it correctly. Type 1 is when the body is not making insulin whatsoever and they have to have insulin from an outside source. But that's only about 5 to 10% of the population. So when you have somebody who's been diagnosed with type 2, they used to say that it was older adults who would get that, and that's no longer true. We now have children who are developing type 2. The youngest child that I know with type 2 is 9 years old. But we have our teenagers, our young adults are all developing type 2 for genetic reasons as well as lifestyle.
And what's type 2 like? What is it?
That's when the body is not making either enough insulin or they can't use it correctly, so they're developing, insulin resistance. Their blood sugar is very high. That's causing blood pressure problems. That's causing vision problems. You think that you have a lot of sugar in your blood and the vessels are very small and they're trying to pump all of that very thick fluid through. It's just not getting to the organs, so there's a lot of stress and strain on the organs, and the kidneys are being affected with trying to filter everything out. And so somebody with type 2 might start off with taking care of their disease through diet and exercise, but it is a progressive disease, and so the organs continue to be affected by the high blood sugars, somebody may end up having to go on oral medication to help make the liver function better or to make the pancreas function better or to make their body more sensitive to the insulin. So what the insulin they are making is being used correctly. And then somebody may progress to insulin because of the body just needs more and more of what they cannot produce themselves.
You said the incidence of diabetes is increasing in the United States.
Yes.
Partly because of lifestyle, but also it's hereditary.
Yes.
And so there's often families with more than one person in the family who has diabetes?
Oh, yes, definitely, especially the type 2. It's very common to have parents, grandparents, siblings, aunts and uncles, cousins. I know of one person who in their family, the mother is the only person in that family without diabetes. The father and the children and the grandparents are all living with it.
Are they insured?
No.
Okay. Tell us about them. What happens to them? Well, How do they do it?
It's very difficult for the uninsured. It's difficult for the underinsured, but it's very difficult for the uninsured. They called me at the agency because they were looking for services to try to get hooked up with ongoing care. We were able to assess their needs, figure out what was going on, finding out what medication they were on, seeing if we can get some free medication through the company, see if there was charitable programs out there besides us that might be able to help. There's two different studies, and I don't mean to do a sidetrack on you here,
Anne,
but there's two different studies that were shown. The DCCT was a 20-year study that showed for people with type 1 that if they kept their diabetes at a near normal level, like the numbers that somebody without diabetes blood sugars would be.
If they can get their levels to that?
Yes.
Yeah.
They could cut their complications up to 2/3. They then followed up that study with a UKPDS, which was a 20-year study for people with type 2, showed the same results, but also showed the importance of not smoking if you have diabetes. Mm-hmm. And so these two studies have shown that people live with diabetes, if they keep their blood sugars at those almost than people living without diabetes mm-hmm. numbers.
Normal, I guess.
Normal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That they could cut those complications by 2/3 so they could avoid the heart attacks, the strokes, the kidney failure, the vision problems.
But if you don't have insurance, they say the studies show, right, Dr. Iannian, that people tend to get help less. So they're going to put off visiting the doctor more often.
Yes, that's right. From a series of studies over the past 20 years, we know that uninsured people with chronic medical conditions like diabetes see their primary doctor less often. They're less likely to get specialty care when they need it. But they are more likely to be hospitalized for complications of the diabetes, such as heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure. And oftentimes they also have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, other risk factors for their health. They can be effectively managed with good primary care, but they miss that opportunity because of being uninsured.
Darlene Honigford, you're with the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. The family you were just talking about, mm-hmm. Do the parents sometimes put things off so that the kids can get what they need?
Yes, I had the mother share that with the father. He had been testing his blood sugars because they've been using the meter kit for the children. And so he's saying, well, I think my blood sugar is this, and then using the things that he needs to do to correct it without knowing 100% exactly that that's what his blood sugar is.
And when you use the meter kit, can't it just use it over and over again?
Well, you can use the meter over and over again. Unfortunately, those strips, you cannot. Once a strip is used, it has to be thrown away, and each meter comes with its own strip. And those they're very expensive, depending on the meter that they have and the if you're doing 3 finger sticks a day, just one person's going through 90 strips in a month.
So those are like those AccuView things we see advertised on television,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's advertised often, which is a reflection of how many people actually need them.
Yes.
I suppose. What about the it says there was a study, I think it was the Institute of Medicine, says that 25% of adult diabetics without insurance for a year or more went without a checkup for 2 years, boosting their risk of health, blindness, and amputations resulting from poor circulation. So what do you do at the association to educate people about what that's going to cost them down the road?
We have nurses and dietitians, and we have a detection coordinator who's out in the community doing the finger sticks, trying to find those people walking around with high blood sugars. Our nurses and dietitians work one-on-one or in a class setting, just trying to do some education and some knowledge. And then I, as a social worker, work with them to try to find some resources for them. But, you know, the people living with diabetes, for the most part, are pretty well aware because of, again, it's genetic. So they saw their grandmother lose a leg, or they saw their uncle pass away from a heart attack or a stroke from diabetes. My own grandmother had a stroke because of her diabetes. And so we do, they're very aware of those complications, and they're aware of the situation that they themselves are facing. And so they are actively looking for the help and for the education, and we're there to just educate and get some resources into their hands.
Dr. Anian, what are some other chronic diseases like diabetes that that people in this country have to live with without insurance?
Well, another important example would be HIV infection or AIDS. There's been a very important study about 6 years ago that showed that people who were living with HIV and lacked insurance had a mortality rate that was substantially higher, so that if people had insurance, particularly when new medications became available in the late 1990s that were very effective in helping people to live with HIV so that it did not progress and cause further complications and death, we found that people who were insured at that time with HIV had an 80% lower risk of death, which is about as large as any effect we see in any sort of medical study of any treatment or, in this case, insurance coverage. So that's another example where, with effective medical care, HIV over the past decade has become more like diabetes. People can live with it as a chronic disease. But if you're uninsured and don't have access to a medical team and those effective medications, like diabetes, you are much more likely to experience serious complications, including death.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, back in the 1980s, you know, mid-1980s, when people were saying if they only could find a cure, if they could only find a way to treat that. And now that we have one, it doesn't necessarily matter. We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking with Dr. John Ianian. He's a practicing physician and also a professor at the Harvard Medical School, and also Darlene Honigford. She's director of social services for the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. We're talking about the uninsured, not politics today. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tell us your story about being denied medication or treatment because you're uninsured. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
WOSU Public Media and PBS present an epic story based on a radical idea that the most special places in the nation should be preserved, not for royalty or for the rich, but for everyone. Evenings this week at 8 p.m., watch Ken Burns' six-part series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, on WOSU-TV. You can visit WOSU.org for complete listings and more information.
And good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Warming up a little bit this morning, 49 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:39. Stay right here in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll hear about the issues of women's ordination into the Catholic priesthood and the response of the Catholic Church to dissent. All that and much more on All Sides with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, sunshine this afternoon and temperatures will rise to about 65 degrees. Mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of showers, maybe thunderstorms throughout the night tonight and a low of 50. For Friday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and thunderstorms throughout the day, a high of 65 on Friday. Looking ahead to Saturday, cloudy skies and a high of 60 degrees. The low Saturday night, right around 46. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher, our discussion today about the uninsured, lives lost and what that costs the rest of us, with Dr. John Iannian of the Harvard Medical School and Darlene Honigford of the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Dr. Iannian, can you talk about uninsured children, what the incidence of that is now and what sort of impact that has on our national healthcare debate?
Sure. In 2007, the number of children who were uninsured was about 8 million or 11% of children and teens in the United States. What's interesting is we already have two programs, the Medicaid program and the CHIP or Children's Health Insurance program, that are those children, about 5.5 million of the 8 million or two-thirds of them are currently eligible for those programs but not enrolled. That's one area where we've made some progress in the past decade is in getting children covered, particularly with expansions of Medicaid and the creation of the Children's Health Insurance program. But there's still many children and families who aren't being reached by that program, and it's important for states to reach out to those families so their children can be covered when they're eligible.
At least, you know, states often, especially right now, aren't reaching out to them because they can't afford it. But that aside, why wouldn't somebody avail themselves of health coverage for their children?
Well, there's certainly many reasons. And with these programs, oftentimes they may not be well publicized, and that varies a lot in different parts of the country. So some parents may not be aware of them. Some programs have complicated enrollment procedures, and people need to re-enroll every 6 to 12 months with substantial paperwork regarding their employment and family incomes. And so sometimes for families that are living close to the edge, both parents may be working or a single-parent household, it just may be very difficult unless the enrollment procedure is streamlined to get those children covered. And it's in everyone's interest for them to be covered because we know that insurance gives children better access to lots of preventive services such as immunizations, evaluations for developmental problems, hearing problems, effects of lead in their blood. And if we can screen and detect those problems early, those children have much better prospects for their health over the rest of their life, and we as a society benefit from that.
When you were talking about the complicated enrollment process, Darlene started nodding her head knowingly. Darlene, what do you know about that process and how it affects the enrollment of people and their children?
It is very complicated, and each program has its own procedures and its own criteria. And some of the families that we work with may be actually the working poor, to where they do have income coming in enough to prohibit them from being able to be eligible in the income guidelines, but it's the signing up and then the re-signing up and the re-enrolling and getting cut off of one managed care program or being put into one managed care program that your doctor may no longer take. I'm working with one family where she's raising her grandchildren, and she was on managed care, and the doctor's plan changed, and her managed care plan changed. They put her into another one that she didn't want, and her doctor no longer took that one. So she has to find another doctor, even though she's worked with that person herself for 15 years, and then having to find another pediatrician who would work or a family physician who would work with those children who would take that particular plan. So it can get very frustrating if you've ever read those forms. It can be pretty convoluted, but having to re-enroll or that you might miss your enrollment date or you get cut off for some reason just gets very, very frustrating.
Someone's out there, I know, thinking right now, well, it's free. So how complicated could it be? It's free. What is the emotional, what happens emotionally with people? I've always had insurance. I'm not going to pretend to empathize. But Darlene, you work with people every day that don't. So what's that like?
Well, the first thing is if you're used to having insurance covered by your employer and either you're laid off or your employer says, you know, to be able to keep the doors open, we have to no longer offer this insurance, you're suddenly in this whole new world. Your life has changed and you're used to paying and you're used to providing, and all of a sudden you have to turn to a subsidized program or state program. And so the pride might take a little bit of a beating, and the, you know, we've have always had that mentality of we can take care of ourselves and, you know, we can, you know, provide for ourselves, and then having to reach out for somebody, one, not knowing if you've never worked, been in the system, you might not even know where to start. And then the that whole emotional toll of I can no longer provide, so now I have to have somebody else provide for my family, when you're used to that, really takes a big toll.
So just filling out those applications can be like pulling taffy.
Oh, and I helped some of the patients fill out the forms, and they can be very confusing when you come in and you have a 15-page form that you have to fill out, and they ask the same question five different ways, and you're trying to make sure that you have all the forms that you need to show them, all of the birth certificates, all of the, you know, housing, and all of the potential income coming in. It just gets really overwhelming. I had a gentleman come in with his wife to fill out a medical disability form on her, and he had a grocery bag full of papers that they have kept just to prove her medical conditions that she's been living with.
Dr. Ayanian, we talked earlier yesterday about the parental coverage issue and why that's important to a child. Can you explain why that is? Even if a child has insurance, why they may not be getting the full complement of services if their parent is uninsured?
Yes, we found in previous work at the Institute of Medicine that if families are covered together on the same insurance plan, particularly low-income families or low- to middle-income families, parents use the healthcare system more effectively, not just for themselves but also for their children. Some of the public programs have been recognizing this pattern and have begun to extend coverage to the parents of children, for example, who may be eligible through the Children's Health Insurance Program. And what we think is going on is that the parents become more familiar with the healthcare system, and in fact, if they're using that insurance plan themselves, they know how to use it more effectively, both for their own care as well as the care of their children.
And maybe they're just healthier, feel better.
That's right. Yes. And, you know, for example, parents who are uninsured with depression are more likely to be depressed or have more severe depression when they're uninsured, even if their children have coverage. And that depression, that mental health issues in the parent can have very major effects on the overall health and well-being of their children. So that's an example where if the parents and children are covered, if the parents suffer from depression and that is treated effectively, it not only has benefits for the adults in question, but also for their children, and that's critically important.
You know, this program's been devoted pretty much to crunching some numbers and talking about some very concrete issues, but there's also sort of that spongy issue out there of quality of life. And you sort of touched on it, Dr. Ayanian, when you're talking about the issue of depression. How much – it seems like Americans really value quality of life unless it's for somebody else.
Sure. That's, you know, I think that the difficult question here is first to think about how we're all better off if everyone has coverage and access to effective care. In our latest report from the Institute of Medicine, when we looked at communities at risk, we actually found that communities with high rates of uninsurance had worse access to care and worse satisfaction with care for everyone in the community, not just the uninsured, but also the insured population. And we also know that in communities with high rates of uninsurance, the hospitals and physicians and other healthcare organizations that serve that community are more financially stressed and may not be able to offer services, for example, high-level trauma care. If you live in a city with a high rate of uninsurance and you have insurance or in a motor vehicle accident, the trauma care that you have access to may not be as effective as if your community had a very low rate of uninsurance, and therefore the services provided could be improved for everyone.
So if you're in a community with a low rate of insurance, you've been in a bad auto accident, let's say you're 16 or 15 years old, the only way you can get anywhere is on a bus or maybe, you know, mooching a ride from somebody. Is that what you're talking about? There's not access the way we think of as access. It's harder to get to it.
Well, it's certainly harder, but also, you know, the the most critical trauma care is provided in high-level trauma centers at major hospitals, and those services may be not as readily available in communities with high rates of uninsurance. Since many of these accidents can't be predicted and affect people with or without insurance, it's one of the ways that everyone in a community can be affected by the rate of uninsurance, even if they or their family are well covered.
I was going to ask you about that. The study says that uninsured trauma victims are less likely to be admitted to the hospital or receive the full range of needed services and are 37% more likely to die of their injuries. How does that happen? How do physicians in a trauma unit make those decisions? Why is that?
It's certainly a sort of a troubling finding. We know that emergency departments in hospitals across the country are required by federal law to evaluate and stabilize patients. Many of the hospitals that are part of our safety net, for example, public hospitals or hospitals in poor urban neighborhoods or isolated rural areas, are very stressed from the care that they're expected to provide. So the care may not be as effective. For example, even if a patient is stabilized, they may not go as promptly to surgery to repair their injuries. The rehabilitation services available to them may not be as effective. So there are many ways that being uninsured can affect the outcomes of trauma, and we see the sum of those effects in some of the studies that you just quoted.
What's the latest on what hospitals spend in indigent care? Do we know that now, or it's in the billions?
It's a substantial number, it's one of the important issues in healthcare reform right now. And I think one of the reasons why many major healthcare organizations are supporting healthcare reform and expanded coverage, because it's very difficult for hospitals and other organizations to cover their costs if they're caring for a very large proportion of uninsured patients, and they are oftentimes needing to cut back on services that they otherwise would be prepared to provide.
Darlene Honigford of the Central Ohio Diabetes Association, do you know of cases where people have tried to get services and are denied because they are uninsured?
Yes, there's some of the families that we're currently working with have no longer being seen by their doctor because of they no longer have insurance, and they have such an outstanding bill that the doctor says, I won't work with you until you pay off this $5,000 tab or whatever that cost may be. So we do see some people who come into our office in that situation where they may have even been fired by their doctor. Doctors can now fire their patients because they're saying that the clients are not cooperative. Well, the client's not cooperative because they can't afford the medication or the testing supplies, or they can't afford to take the class that the doctor wanted them to sign up for.
Do you think doctors are just mean?
No. We work with plenty of doctors, and I do not believe they're just mean. I just feel that it's also a business, and they have to just operate, unfortunately, in the situation that we're all currently facing.
Dr. Ayanian, can you sort of summarize for us what the benefit would be to the country, regardless of whatever's brewing in Washington right now? But if people were insured in this country, if everybody had medical coverage, what would the benefit be? What could we see concretely?
We'd see many positive benefits. I think first and foremost, people would have better access to care. They'd be less likely to delay seeking care or avoid seeking care because of the cost. Extending coverage would not eliminate some of these problems or issues in one stroke. We certainly have to, at the same time, work to improve the healthcare system for everyone. There are many ways in which our healthcare system is fragmented. Care is not well coordinated between different sites of care, and that certainly contributes to the rising costs. And there are many people who don't at present, even with insurance, necessarily have access to a regular primary care physician. So I think at the same time that we extend coverage and improve access, we also have to work on how we finance healthcare and how we deliver it so that the quality of care and the outcomes of care are better for everyone. With the coverage, though, based on the many, many studies that we've reviewed at the Institute of Medicine, we've concluded that that not only would access to care improve, but people would have better health outcomes, access to appropriate medical services that improve their health outcomes. So better quality of life, longer survival, and very importantly, less concern about the financial consequences of health care when you're uninsured. What's ironic is that uninsured people are oftentimes the only group in the country that pay the full list price of medical services. In fact, many insurers and the federal government negotiate discounted prices that are not available to people without insurance. So there's also a risk of extreme financial hardship that would be alleviated by extending coverage to all Americans.
Darlene, from the point of view of someone who works with people who live with a chronic condition, diabetes, every day, what would the benefit be? I mean, would you be put out of business?
We actually work daily to put ourselves out of business. have a saying at the office, we'd be all happy to brush up our resume if there was a cure for diabetes, and we'd just move on to the next health issue. But was mentioned, the quality of life would just be wonderful. You know, the worry wouldn't be there. The depression wouldn't be there. When, again, you're taking care of your disease, the complications would be alleviated. There's actually been studies that have shown that if somebody's able to take care of their health, they could prevent the actual onset of diabetes. And so I think that the quality of life would just be huge because of, as you said, that you're not worrying and you're really preventing the complications that come along with living with another chronic disease.
Parents with children who have diabetes, if the parent was insured as well as the child, what sort of differences do you think you'd see?
Well, we would have a much healthier group of children coming in. We wouldn't have to worry about a child who was diagnosed with diabetes at age 9 and possibly being on kidney dialysis at the age 29. And we wouldn't have to worry about somebody who's not going to be able to be a viable part of the workforce. We would have people with diabetes out there contributing to the world and just being an active part of their life.
We're running out of time. I've been talking with Dr. John Iannian of the Harvard Medical School and Darlene Honigford of the Central Ohio Diabetes Association. We've been talking about how many uninsured Americans are out there, roughly 46 million, but more specifically, the ones that are uninsured and may die because they lack health insurance. That number ranges anywhere from a low of 18,000 to an estimated high of 46,000 a year. Dr. Iannian, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And Darlene Honigford, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your point of view.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take off now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.